This episode of Fuel for the Soul is powered by ASICS. Head over to ASICS.com and sign up for a one ASICS account. It's completely free, and when you sign up, you will receive 10% off your first purchase. You'll also gain access to exclusive colorways on ASICS.com, free standard shipping, special birthday month discounts, and more.
Hi, this is Thomas with Believe in the Run.
This is Megan with Believe in the Run.
And this is Megan with Featherstone Nutrition,
aka Feathers.
And today we have a very special guest on the show who we met at Boston Marathon weekend, right?
Yep. You and guys did, but I got to meet her in Paris, and swooped her up and didn't let go of her for the, how many days were we there? Five or six. So if anyone's wondering who we are talking about Emily Saul, who is with us here today to share with us some of her sports psychology background as that intertwines and weaves into sports nutrition, which we know those two pieces are very closely tied together. So we are very excited to have Emily Saul with us here today to weigh in a little bit on some different topics that we've talked about on the podcast. And I know I can't do it justice. So Emily, I'm going to let you tell us a little bit about yourself and introduce yourself and all your wonderful credentials behind that name.
But before we go into that, I'm going to cut her off real quick. This still has something to do with nutrition because I eat all my feelings and try to store them down deep. And then I vomit them all back up on Megan when I get a chance. So yeah. It still has to do with nutrition.
It definitely, all of this definitely has to do with deal with nutrition. And gosh, we can get into that too if you want, but that'll be just like our lunch in Boston, which I know you enjoyed so much. Well, thank you. I'm really excited to be here and talk with all of you today. My background, I'm a sports psychology coach. My background is in counseling, like clinical psychology with a specialty in sports psychology. And I come to this field as a lifelong athlete. I was a collegiate rower. I am a many time marathoner, do a lot of running. Strength coaching is in my background. I do a lot of push-ups every day as well. And so physical movement is a big and important part of my life. And so my background in sports psychology really originated because I had this experience of being an athlete and feeling like I was learning as much, if not more, about myself and the world and relationships and just sort of being, developing as a person through my sport, as I was through my academic education in college or anything else. And I really began to see movement as a space where people can begin to explore themselves and better understand who they are and what they're trying to do and what kind of impact they have, but also understand some of the challenges and use that movement space and their movement practice in their own lives as a space to better understand those challenges, learn from them, and then apply them everywhere in their life. And so the work that I do with athletes is really about their relationship with their movement practice, building that understanding, finding pathways for development and growth. And that can sometimes look like trying to enhance specific athletic performance, like I want to reach these particular goals. And so how do I get my head on board and out of my own way? But also, people are often looking for more of a sense of meaning and purpose in their movement. A lot of times, and you all are experienced enough runners to know, sometimes you can do a thing enough times that you start to go, why am I even doing this? Like, what is this for? And that's also where I do a lot of work with people, because it is really fun to chase times or to seek out specific performance or outcome goals. But we all have limitations and capacities in that development. And so, you know, for those of us who are probably not getting much, much faster in our lives based on our age. it's a really important thing to be able to cultivate a sense of purpose and meaning and define success in ways that are meaningful for you, regardless of the times that are going to show up on the clock. So so hopefully that gives a good picture of.
All right. So let's stop the show now and I'll just pay the whatever your hourly rate is and we'll dive into it. You nailed all my shit right there in life. in that. But no, seriously, the quick question for you is so I'm always curious because I'm getting more and more into meditation and the mind-body connection. Is there a chicken and egg thing or are they dependent on each other in a symbiotic way? Like, how do you view that, especially since most of what you're doing is the psychology behind performance and sport? But why do we feel they're separate? Why does our body and our mind seem so unconnected?
You just asked like four or five really good questions. So how long do we have to talk here? so body-mind connection, yes, they're definitely connected. Technically, developmentally, we have a little bit of a brain and not much of a mind when we're physically born. So we've got more body, but our body does a huge amount of developing, like up through puberty, and that's when. So it takes 15 years or so to get our full physical development, and even more than that. But neurologically speaking, we're still in 80% of our brain development happens in the first 5 years. But we are still developing neurologically until we're about 26 years old. And there's just a very strong relationship between body and mind. And it's our cognitive mind that we tend to think of as like our thinking part. Like that's where we can make meaning out of things and try to understand things in more complex ways. And that's the part that is last to develop. That's the part that's really still developing until the mid-20s. And so like they absolutely interplay in the field of neuroscience. They talk about top-down regulatory control and also bottom-up. And so the bottom-up refers to the body is speaking to the brain, the meaning-making part of our brain in our prefrontal cortex. But the top-down is I can make decisions about things and decide on things, and that can have an influence then on my emotions as well as on my physical state. So the cool thing about mindfulness is that you are, when you practice meditation, is that you're making a conscious choice and you're using a practice that requires regulation with your thinking brain, but you are having an influence then over those lower parts of your brain. And that then enhances your ability to like be less reactive to things, which again, and being reactive is the bottom part of your brain reacting as if you're in like a survival mode or situation, and just feeling like you have a little bit more of a, like your hands on the steering wheel of yourself, your experience there. So there's tons to explore in terms of the up and down, the back and forth between body and mind. But I think that's really what sports psychology is. It's this constant back and forth and exploration of what happens when my physical body does this, how do I think about it or how do I feel about it? And then when I think about things this certain way, do I actually experience things differently in the felt sense of it? And so that's where we learn what's helpful for us, as well as, oh, I've been doing things in a way that's not very helpful for me. Maybe I can work on shifting that.
And I have to say, I have some clients that I've been like, hey, maybe we could talk to Emily, you know, and I can physically, like when I Zoom with them each week, I can see the change in how they're thinking and processing things. And it's such a breath of fresh air to have them bring kind of that more open mind, as Emily was saying, kind of redefining why they're running certain things, and all of a sudden then they're open to more things from a nutrition space. So it's just been really cool to kind of see some of the development from kind of almost behind the scenes of how much working with someone like Emily to kind of change that thought process and understand and how it can affect all aspects of running, including nutrition, which is why we wanted to bring her on and give us some tips here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that gives one follow-up question. So you go in to somebody who is going to help you with sports psychology, but everybody mm-hmm. has all this other crap that they're carrying around. Do you have to get rid of the crap first before you can get to the sports psychology, or do you just go in straight and be like, let's just talk about the athletic pursuit and how I can help there?
It depends on who you are. So I know I'd love to give you like a real simple answer, but it really does depend on the person. I think there are some people who are very focused in the sports space and are like, okay, these are tools that I want to work on developing, or here's specific situations. A good example is I work with a lot of people who are training for marathons. And so as they are getting closer to the actual race, they may be a lot of the way through their training when they reach out. And we spend a lot of time really preparing them specifically for the race and building a mental race plan and okay. just navigating that kind of thing. But for a lot of people who might be questioning, why am I still doing this? Or what am I trying to do here? Or, you know, I've achieved these goals and why don't I feel satisfied? Those kinds of things. Then usually there's some other pieces that are worth exploring, because they are, what they've been experiencing is they're looking for certain things through running that are maybe not getting satisfied. And we have to better understand what those are in order to find more effective ways of meeting those particular needs, as well as then allowing them to craft their relationship with running in a way that just feels better.
It's funny because I listen to that and I think of like stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And I would say, usually you would say women are more emotional and men are more stoic. And I look at the two women that are I'm on this panel with here, Megan and Megan. These two are really in control of their emotions and focus. And I am a garbage can of emotions swirling around. I don't understand. Like, what happened? It's not fair.
We're breaking gender stereotypes over here.
And they're both fairly successful. Well, I don't want to put labels on running. They're successful runners, though, because what I'm going to say is that they set a goal and they're able to pursue that goal and not let the garbage can of emotions get in the way of that goal. Mm-hmm. Versus, I think you guys are really good at compartmentalizing as well. Versus myself, who I feel like I'm hit or miss all over the board. I'm throwing darts everywhere. And I do think there's a component to the psychology of the focusing on the goal that I have somehow lacked. But these two have already kind of mastered? I don't know if mastered. I'm sure you guys need work too, but
yeah, I'm no master of anything over here.
No, it's an ongoing process of exploration and understanding. But I think we can talk more about how your mindfulness practice is helping you with that, or what kind of effect that's having. I think we can definitely have more conversation there. But yeah, it's a really good observation around how people like dial into particular things. Some people find that that's what they love the most about running is they talk about like running forces me, or running like really makes me focus only on this thing. And I usually remind them that it's them who is allowing themselves to be just fully present in their running, that they're choosing to not bring in everything else in life into that moment. And so in that way, that's working really effectively for them. But other people actually want to be emotional, or like have that sense of emotional connection to running. It's people just have really different ways of going about it. I mean, I'm with you. I'm definitely one to be like, I want this to be like impassioned, and I want it to be like big and important, and I'll take the highs and lows because I want to feel all of that all the time.
Yeah, I'm feeling too much.
All right, we can build a dial. We can build a dial. Yeah. Dial it up, dial it down.
Megan's telling me to get like what is it? We were walking by a cannabis store. She's like, you sure you don't want to try something like that?
Huh? She's not just in the door. Like. So we have some common scenarios that we see with runners that kind of interplays sports psychology with nutrition. So we wanted to go through a few of them. Like you said, we might get through all of them. We might get through like one because we want to talk so much about it. But so the first one is one that we see a lot, and we've actually answered that question on the podcast before. And it's people's, they're writing in and they're saying, I just ran this race, typically a half marathon or a marathon. And they're like, I crushed it. I PR'd. I've never performed so well in my life, .. But I saw the race pictures and I hate the way I look. Mm. You know, my weight's a little bit up. So, you know, from a sports dietitian perspective, I'm like, you're fueling like a boss and you're performing better than you ever can. Can't we just focus on that instead of the way our body looks, right? But I know like it's not as easy as that. So I wanted to bring that up and just kind of get your take, your feedback, like how you would approach something like that to help someone through the body image thoughts when performance is actually doing better.
Well, and you've answered it before, and so like what is the context that you've talked about this or responded to this challenge?
Sure. And I think, you know, shifting our focus and thinking more about when we fuel X, Y, and Z, what are the benefits of that? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the benefits of fueling our body adequately? And the results are better performance. And is there better mental health? Is there, you know, what are the good things about fueling our body well enough to perform well? And then it's kind of like this outlier, this other voice in their mind of, but I don't like what I look like when I'm eating the way to perform my best. Right. So I always just try to get people to shift and focus on the positives, but I'm sure there's probably a better way to approach
that. Yeah, don't look at your photos.
No, that
throw them away.
That is a really good it is a really good point, because we do want to see the value in nutrition. You know, as I was thinking through some of like this question in particular and some of the others that we hope to get to, the thing that kept coming up for me is that it feels like there's this general belief about nutrition that either you like nourish your body or you like everything else about yourself. Like it's this framing of nutrition as this like competition with these other things that we want. So almost like we can't have it all. And so like that's the piece that I would really start with for people is looking more on the level of like values and beliefs. Because if you believe that, that nutrition is in some way, a bad thing, like it is in the way of liking myself or liking how I look or liking my race photos, then you're always going to feel like there's something that you're sacrificing. And if your values speak to, I really want to look good, or I want people to like how I look, or that sort of externally driven, kind of thing, which like all of us have some sense of that, some element of that, then we're always going to feel like we're sacrificing something. And I don't think that we have to sacrifice a sense of self or a sense of like feeling good about ourselves in order to nourish ourselves or be properly fueled, to train. So, you know, so I really get into this idea of you got to know what you're trying to do, and you have to be willing to prioritize that specific thing. So when someone says, I'm going to run a marathon and I really want to do what it takes to perform my best, it's great that they're getting nutrition guidance and that they're able to sort of take on that fueling. And if that really is the thing that is most important, then whatever their body needs to do. So if it does make some changes, maybe you do add a little weight to your body, which is helping to sustain your performance, to look at that as a, like that's in service of this particular thing that you're trying to accomplish with your running, and to stay oriented around that being the thing of value right now. Like, that is my priority. And so when I do eat and when my body looks like this, it's all working toward that particular priority. And alternatively, if the really important thing for you, like if what you're valuing most is, I want to look really good, in quotes, like I want to look a particular way in running photos, then like go set up a photo shoot with with a sports photographer and do that. Like, nobody says that you have to post the race photos from the race that you actually ran. Like, I actually know some sports photographers who would
love this
session with you, but like,
I think there's a problem here. I think there's two things that are colliding.
Okay.
So I think a lot of people get into running for the fitness.
Yeah.
And to get into shape and to look good. And there's also, there's somewhat of a picture in your mind of what that looks like. So you see an elite athlete and you're like, that is what a runner looks like. And look how they perform and look how fast they are. And that goes. So that's how you get into the sport. And then the second thing that happens is you get into the sport for a little bit and you're no longer satisfied with your times. And and you start looking at your peers around you and the neighbors and the anybody else you know who runs. And then you start going, well, I want to be fit and I want to be fast. And it starts to converge into this space. So when you say get into the reasons why you want to do it, I don't think there's a pure like, I want to be the best marathoner. I want to be a super fit model. Because I know tons of runners that want both those things.
Yeah. Well, I also want to like not necessarily have to work and in order to earn money. And I want to eat an entire container of cookie dough and not feel gross afterwards. Like, we can
That is weird about the cookie dough, though.
Yeah, right?
That's a lot of cookie dough.
I would do it. We can want anything we decide, right? We can decide to want certain things, but just because we decide it does not necessarily make it realistic, doesn't necessarily make it possible, doesn't even necessarily make it helpful for us.
So do you think there's cognitive dissonance when somebody goes and says, I want to be fast and I want to be fit, and they just choose the fit over fueling, and then their results aren't good, so then they're upset with their running results, or vice versa?
Yeah. Do you know why so many people reach out to work with me? Because they find themselves in exactly that cycle. And also, nice job dropping the psychological jargon there. Cognitive dissonance.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, and that's where we get those, essentially those competing priorities, is when someone says, I want to be fit, they have decided what fit looks like without necessarily looking at the accurate information about their own body, that means in order to do specific things that are what indicate I am fit, like, or what fit people can do, I'm essentially expecting my body to just be able to produce that without giving it the fuel. And so you keep, someone can just keep saying like, but I want this and I want this. Like, well, those two things don't necessarily go together. There are certain people for whom their body might look a particular way, and you might label that as like, well, that's fit, or that's what a quote real runner looks like, but that doesn't mean that that's what your body is going to look like when you are best nourished and fueled to be able to run to your best potential. So yeah, I think there's a lot of dissonance for people, and it does, it builds into cycles where, and I like the reference that you made to people getting into it because they want to I think a lot of people want to feel more fit. They notice that it often makes some kind of changes in their bodies. So they make this quick assumption. This is a shortcut of logic that is, if I did this and I got, so if I did a little bit more activity and I saw some change in my body, then the logical shortcut is, so I just do more of that and I'll see more of that change in my body, which is true to a degree. But it's not just a never-ending trajectory, as we know, because you hit a limit. You can't necessarily just run exponentially more miles and expect yourself to get faster, because you'll break. You can't just continue to do more and more without also relatively increasing your fuel and expect your body to do anything but eventually break. We have to be able to look at the interplay, and that's a lot of the conversations that I have with people, really getting at, okay, well, what is important to you? Is it most important to you to look in this particular way that you've defined? And if that is, for you, the most important thing, I don't have this conversation with any judgment. If that's the important thing, then you will find some limitation in what you're able to physically perform, how you're able to produce results. So then how do you feel about that? Like, is that what you're going for? And what I find when you can really work through some of those pieces with people is that a lot of people are actually more interested in feeling capable, feeling strong, working toward their potential, sort of seeing what they're able to do. That ends up being much more rewarding, a much richer experience for them than just, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but like that is more rewarding for them than simply looking a particular way, because,
yeah.
Right?
Well, one follow-up comment to that, though, is that even, like, I don't know anybody who's 100% happy with their body anyway, you know?
Yeah.
I see really fit people, then they'll still critique themselves.
We also joked in the beginning of this question about like not looking at your race photos or throwing them away. But yeah. Honestly, if like I know when I first started working with Megan, one of the first things she said was, if getting on the scale like is going to derail your day, if you see a certain number, then don't get on the scale. So right. I'm kind of like, does it make sense to just, if you're really if it's going to upset you that much, just don't look at them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's very reasonable. I also think about when you do look at the race photos, to be able to keep in context, as I was saying before, like what was the priority there? Like, was your priority while running this marathon to look really happy and like not on a downstep ever? Then you probably need to spend like time and energy navigating where are the photographers, and then like you are giving up priority to the time, and you're saying like, okay, when the photographer's there, like you're gonna stop, you're gonna be like, okay, I'm coming, like, and approach in a very careful way and like cue them to take the right photos. You could do that too, but again, you're then trying to do something different than just race. So I had an interesting experience in this context, racing in Paris a couple months ago. I looked at all my photos and like, I'm usually pretty good at like, I notice where the photographers are and I'll like throw a smile on my face. I had one photo where I was actually smiling during this race because I saw someone I knew, like someone from Boston was in Paris, and I was like, whoa. And he happened to be standing next to a photographer. So there's a single photo. And then every other one, I am like serious, like laser focused, dialed in. And I'm like, wow. Yep, that accurately represents what I did in that race. Like, I had a blast, but I like did not pay attention to people or things. I just was like running a race.
And she PR'd, ladies and gentlemen, so we know what her focus was.
Yeah. That's right. And I had an amazing experience internally. It just doesn't show in the photos. And so I think there just has to be more of a conversation about it. Like, and it really very simplistically comes down to, are you running a marathon for the photos? And if you are, there are better there are better ways to get those kinds of photos than hoping that you acquire them through race course photography.
So this is funny because Megan's last race, I went and did photos instead of running this time. And she got, I think, phenomenal photos.
Yeah.
And she won the race. So she was able to do both.
Yeah, so or bring your own photographer to the race if that's...
That knows your angles.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Because when you have a personal photographer who can take a big, big volume, even if you're a skilled photographer, you're still going to get a fraction of like those really great ones compared to the total number that you take. Because running's kind of an ugly sport, right? It's messy. It's sweaty. There's a lot of downstep. Like it's all of those things. So.
Megan does so full much, makeup before so every step. Race.
I love that.
No, she doesn't. I'm kidding about that.
Yeah.
So I think like the takeaway here is you've heard us talk a lot on this podcast about choosing your focus, choosing whether you want to fuel for performance or fuel for body composition changes. So now we have, I didn't even know I was setting up myself for the support here, but now we have a different focused person on sports psychology saying the exact same thing. We pick our focus and that's where we put our energy towards. So I think, you know, it's nice to have the background of that here.
I was going to say it ties into something we were talking about before the podcast, before you came in. There's time, there's seasons for how you do your fueling. So right now I'm not running as much. I'm kind of taking a down period. But like, no, I literally have cut back on like how much I'm fueling just because I'm not doing the same amount of exercise. Mm-hmm. So knowing that, then when I go back into marathon training with for New York this year, I'm going to start adding back in calories, adding stuff back in.
Yep.
So, you know, you can, if you're not doing it racing all the time, you can kind of adjust your diet to your needs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that emphasis on choice. I mean, we get to choose a lot of things in life. We don't get to just choose, like decide by personal choice what like volume and quality of nutrition our bodies need to run most to our potential. But we really do get to decide what, like I said, what our values are, how we talk to ourselves, how I treat myself, what mindset I bring to my running. So choosing to operate as an underfueled runner doesn't make you better at running. But choosing to operate with a mindset that motivates and supports who I am as a person and what my capable body looks and feels like when it's well-fueled, that actually does make you better at running.
I think that segues nicely into another scenario that I see very often of athletes stuck in a cycle of underfueling, yet unable to get themselves out of it. They're stuck in an injury cycle of, I understand that my underfueling is causing these injuries, but yet they've got all the tools, all the resources, but yet they just can't seem to get past the underfueling piece. Yeah. So I know it's very individualized based on why someone might be underfueling, but I'm just curious if you hear the kind of that high level of somebody stuck in an underfueling cycle that is constantly getting injured, like what would be your first tip or suggestion or, you know, where would you kind of head with someone in that scenario?
Yeah. And it really is. It's a common one. So lots of people experience this. So the first thing that I really try to do with people, and it goes back to what I was saying about just understanding your relationship with your movement practice, is I try, instead of just saying like, okay, let's try to convince you to take different actions, I try to take a step back and ask the person to describe the cycle with me, like help me understand each of these pieces, like what happens first and then what happens next. So like, you know, I underfuel, it like works in a way for a time and I feel really good and then I get injured and then I can't. And then, so we cycle through all that because I want to help them just become more consciously aware of the relationship between like actions and effects. So that we're not doing anything, or we're not talking about anything that's like under the layer of consciousness, that they're really aware of that cycle. And then I really try to understand, how they feel about that. So what's the layer of like emotions, feelings about themselves, or just kind of feelings through the course of it. So we've got like what's happening, and then how is it feeling? How's it affecting me? And this is where we get a little bit into history with people, is I want to understand, like where that comes from, as in, sometimes we can identify certain origins, or we can look at where there are experiences that are kind of similar to this earlier in life. But there's usually more to uncover when we're in a cycle like this, because the like incessant or almost uninterruptible cycle that happens of like, I know better, I'm doing something that's not really helpful for me, and I can't not do it. Well, that's, in my experience, that's not speaking about like I need to run. It's running represents, or running is more of a solution or an access point to something else that I'm needing, and that need isn't getting met. And that's why I continue to work toward, or work in this way. So essentially, we're trying to figure out what are some of the needs in that person, psychologically, emotionally, physically, that aren't actually getting met. And once we can better understand what those are, it's way easier to address those, and then that cycle is much differently interrupted. And usually not because I'm trying to convince somebody to do something differently, because it just makes sense. It's a much more like intuitive and organic kind of shift for them, that they don't need to attempt to do this particular thing in that same way, because they're not fighting for a certain need to be met. It's getting met otherwise.
Is the need typically love? Like, is it like acceptance and feeling self-worth and love? Is that normally what it comes down to in some form or another?
I would say that's pretty common. There are some like variations of that, but you know, it is an absolutely essential part of human development that we. Like fundamental human psychological needs are like, we need to feel like we matter. We need to feel like we're safe first and foremost, but we need to feel like we matter. We have value. You know, we need to feel like we have some like choice and effect in our experiences, and that our efforts have an effect in the world. And a sense of belonging. And so, I mean, if somebody is, for whatever reason, not feeling any of those particular things, not feeling connected, or not feeling like they matter or have value, you know, running and sport and those things that have these outward physical achievements, they produce this result, are some of the easiest ways to go, look, I did a thing, or look, that seems to matter to people. And so it's a pathway to feel a certain thing, but those pathways don't necessarily always meet the need. And that's why you find that a lot of people are like striving and striving and striving toward particular goals. And even when they get there, they still kind of feel a little bit dissatisfied or empty or not quite satiated. And so we have to go back and really find, again, more effective ways to meet that. So, you know, somebody being able to say, I feel really proud of myself, or I feel really proud of the effort that I put in. I feel proud of what I achieved and accomplished, even if I didn't hit my goal time. Like for me, that's a huge development for somebody, because so often they're looking to achieve something as an outcome in order to feel worthy or accomplished, or like, you know, sometimes it is to feel like lovable, or that they have like earned feeling like enough. And I'm always working to actually reorganize that it's the enoughness that you have. It's the inherent value that you have as a human being. That is actually what allows you to strive for and ever achieve any of those goals that you set. It's not like feeling enough and feeling like you hold value as a person is not the reward after you've achieved those things. It's the foundation from which you seek out those things.
So you're saying we already have that?
Yeah.
Wait, yeah, like, I'm still digging for that bone.
I know. The running industry, I don't think, wants us to know that, though, so maybe don't tell.
I won't tell anyone.
Yeah, no. Generally speaking, the running industry and races and all that do a pretty good job of perpetuating the idea that, like, just do another race, you know, just achieve the next thing. And like, that'll be great. But
I do think, though, if you do that enough, that you start to love the process of training. I to a certain degree, I love the training almost more than the actual event, except for when the event's like a Boston and then it's just insane. But the training and the lifestyle and the discipline and the doing hard things when you don't feel like doing them is I think the greatest thing that I've gotten out of running.
Yeah.
Other than friends and stuff like you guys.
No, I love that. And I think that, you know, that speaks to somebody who's spent some time like muddling through the challenges of having a movement practice like running, because it isn't always, we're not always going to get those outcome results that we like, you know, crave or want or would be nice. But when you can find value in that whole process and you can find, really rewarding returns on the effort that don't depend on whether race day turns out in some particular way or not. A good way to describe it is if you can arrive to a starting line knowing that you have already achieved, you have accomplished, like there's all kinds of things that you've learned and ways that you've developed and grown. And that all of those things that you've already done through the training, those are not on the table. They're already yours. They can't go away regardless of how the race time actually ends up. And being able to trust that and really know that, I've gotten a lot of what I've been looking for. That's exactly what you're describing. Like the best part's actually done. And then race day is just a day that has so many other factors that influence it that are out of your control that you don't need to hang your sense of worth on or the value or existence of all of that work and training on how that one day goes. So you're separate those two things out. It makes a really big difference in how you can experience and even be open to a race day and the potential that's there.
Well, that gave me chills. I got goosebumps. I didn't need a tissue, but
we're not crying. I love it. Today.
I think that's a great, yeah. And I think too, meeting people like all you guys, and you know, I know some people like to bash on social media, but being able to share some of these experiences with other people, I feel like really encourages being able to do exactly what you just said, you know, sharing these shared experiences with other people and enjoying the people you're around and seeing people and meeting people and all that kind of stuff just seemed, at least for me, a really helpful piece of exactly what you're describing.
Yep. So I know you guys, Megan, you had mentioned like wanting to talk about data and tracking. I feel like that would be super helpful to talk about too.
Well, I think you know, when I work with people, we have so many gadgets, right? And we've talked about it on the show too. We have so many ways that we track data, including nutrition and weight and body composition. You know, there's like DEXA salons now where you can go and get your body composition done every 3 months, like the gold standard. I've never even had that done. Like, I thought it was just for NFL players and people with low bone density, but now, you know, there's like these salons, we can go do it. So, you know, there's so much data at our fingertips. And I think that sometimes the typical runner personality might actually not be the most benefited from all of this data. So I'm just curious, like, put it in your bucket here, you know, give us some of your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, I want to get one more layer of detail from you. So in regards to nutrition, how do you see people use nutrition tracking as in a helpful way? And then in what ways does it become essentially unhelpful?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So what I've found is helpful with people is identifying timing and what. So understanding when we're eating throughout the day and then what we're eating throughout the day. Not necessarily all the numbers, all the pieces, a counting down calorie count as the day goes on. Those are the types of things that I see as very harmful. Yeah. Focusing too much on the numbers, seeing your total energy needs for the day dwindling, and then that dictating our nutrition habits instead of listening to our body. So the what and the when is what I find helpful for tracking. And then all the other pieces that kind of intertwine and get a little more specific than that is what I see can potentially be harmful instead of helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So that's really helpful for me because, I tend to look at, I look at most things, much less with the lens of like good and bad, right and wrong. And I really try to look at things as, is it helping you or is it not? As in, like, is it being a support in the direction that is, that your like goals are or that you're trying to move toward, or is it getting in the way? Is it creating more challenge or barriers, towards those things that you're working on? And so in the context of, especially of nutrition, the way that you just framed that, like we want to know when people are eating and what they're eating, because what makes a big difference in terms of what kind of energy they have, when it really explains this much bigger picture. So we're looking to have this better, bigger understanding of what are you working with and what are you putting in? Therefore, what are you getting out? That I think is a really helpful frame of looking at it. And the more people can have that bigger picture, then they're like, oh, things start to make sense. And as soon as things make sense for people, they will like abide by and follow and like sort of do things that are helpful when it makes sense. People will like push back and fight and be resistant if things don't make sense. So by giving that bigger picture, it helps things to just make better sense. And typically when people get so focused on those micro details, like I need to know, was it a tablespoon and a half or was it 2 tablespoons of peanut butter? Like I need to know exactly that, or how many slices of this or whatever, like down to the calories and all those fine, fine details. What actually starts to happen for people is that the task of tracking becomes the goal, rather than tracking being a supportive tool that helps you work toward a goal. And this, I think, is something that happens a lot for runners. Like, there are so many type A runners out there who like to be really like organized and methodical and specific. And there is this very common strong belief that if I just do it exactly right, I will get all the things I decided I want, right? So I want to do this and that. And that's just a belief that people hold that isn't always accurate. And so with that being the belief, the more specific, the more methodical I can get, the more exacting my success is going to be, the more I can guarantee these outcomes that I really want. And so it actually shifts the action or the task of tracking into its own task that I can be successful at. And so I actually end up feeling like so good, not because of the information that I put in, because I did it so right.
I feel like I know athletes on both sides of that. Like,
yeah.
I feel like Ben Johnson is someone that puts a plan together, follows a plan, and executes on it. Like,
yeah.
It's insane. Like, I don't know anybody else who can just write it down and it happens.
But, yeah.
I think the rest of us.
Right,
I've heard people say, or and I've even said to myself, I worked so hard in this training, I did everything right, I deserved a better outcome.
Yes, yes, that's such a common thing, right? And that's a belief that if I do this, then I deserve this particular outcome. And that's actually a moralistic belief. Like, if I do good things, then good things should happen to me. But like, also, you can work really, really hard and not have the desired outcome. And that says that outcome says nothing about how hard you worked. But if you hold in your head, the only thing that makes my hard work valid is if I get this outcome I deserved, then we turn it into like, then I must be a bad person, or I must be not good enough, or maybe I'm not deserving of. And like, that's where we get into the sense of self-doubt, and, you know, we tank our self-worth for unrealistic or sort of unreasonable in unreasonable ways. It's not really justified. And so, you know, there are, I love that there are certain very rare exceptions of people who can set a plan, put it down and execute. And almost everybody else, you like a plan is a good idea and it's a helpful thing to follow. But it's not a guarantee about anything. And so when it comes down to this, the tracking element and like using the data, and this is true for nutrition, but it's true for following training plans and everything else. The success of your training is not defined by how perfectly you follow a training plan. The success of your nutrition tracking is not defined by how perfectly and to whatever detail you track everything. It's much more about how did you allow the tracking of this information to inform you? How did you allow that to support the effectiveness of the whole plan? And we see that in the run training, because, you know, people will stop their watches and try to essentially tailor their data so that it looks a certain way on Strava or on their training plans for their coaches to see. And so I really work with people on allowing the accurate data to reflect what you really did in order to learn from that and continue to tailor the training plan in the most effective way. And so nutrition tracking is exactly the same thing. Like, the point is not to feel like you're being watched, and so I should eat less or more or whatever in order to make it look a certain way. It's really about, Megan, as you said, we want to know what is happening. We want to know when it's happening, and we want to know what kind of effect it has, because then we can learn from it and tailor what we're doing so that it works better for you in the service of running. So we just want to be aware of when the way that we're tracking information continues to support our efforts and our development as people and as runners, and when the tracking itself actually becomes its own task and often counterproductive to what we're trying to do with our...
I have a question for Megan. When you were journaling and keeping track of your calories for Feathers, was there ever a time where you, like, when, you know, people stop their watch when they're taking a break because they don't want their overall pace to so is there anything that you ever left out or wanted
no,
to?
No, but there was a few evenings where I would go out where I would just wrote, had several beverages.
Yeah. And we weren't tracking calories, Thomas. We were doing the what and the when then, too.
I know, but I just was curious if she was stopping her diet watch.
No, but I think she was pretty truthful there.
No, she is.
And then Thomas was just like, yeah, I don't know if tracking is for me. So I don't think you were lying either.
No, I wasn't lying. I was just like, Okay, so you know how some people look at their Strava and they're happy with it because they're like, oh, these numbers are meeting what I like. When I was tracking this stuff, I was like, okay, this is boring and I'm close enough. And so like if it was a 12-minute pace day of eating, that was okay.
Yeah.
Well, and to Emily's point, like if it's not serving us, we don't do it. Like I've had plenty of people that will start tracking and then I'm like, I don't know that this is actually what's helping us right now. And you literally just put into words why I do the things I do better than I could have ever put it into words. So I'm just going to clone your thoughts there and distribute that out because, yeah, you were able to completely articulate the purpose of nutrition tracking and when it's helpful and when it's not. Yeah.
I'm not a numbers guy, period, except for when it comes to pace, unfortunately. But that, like, Meg will say, I'll say, Meg, do I look like I've gained some weight? And she goes, your clothes still fitting you? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, do you want to get on the scale? And I'm like, nah. So, like, keeping track of the data for me, unless there was, like, a watch, like, it syncs with Strava, like, it just doesn't work for me. I'm not a data person.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I know a lot of people who they believe that having all of that data like is helpful to them. I think the psychology behind it is actually getting at not just do you think it's helpful or have you decided that it's helpful for you, but like let's actually look at what happens to you. Like how does it really feel when you're doing that? Because in some ways they might classify it as being helpful because it satisfies that very sometimes obsessive but very like rigid idea of I need to do it perfectly or I want it to be just so and that little feeling of satisfaction that feels good, so like yeah, that's helping me. But when we look at how it's actually deconstructing people's progress forward or it's really causing like a disruption of your priorities. Like you're focused so much on just doing it in this exact way that you've decided it has to be, that isn't helping you do these other things because there are these now rules that exist that are preventing you from doing other stuff. So it is really helpful to just keep kind of peeling back the layers with people. They go, well, tell me more about this. And like, let's really understand what happens there. And, you know, what those rules are. So I'm always for helping build more awareness, more conscious awareness of what are those beliefs that you're operating under. And, you know, Thomas, you just did a great job of describing, like, I don't think I need data in order to feel happy or satisfied with what I'm doing. Like, that's a really helpful belief for you. And that doesn't have to be the same for everybody else, but it's good to know what works for you.
Yeah, do you still track?
Track what?
Either weight or...
Nope.
Like food?
Nope. Yeah, because when you can build good patterns. So, Meg, how do you know that things feel, are like feeling good or on track or are like working for you?
For me personally, or her personally. I was like, huh?
Yeah, sorry, you asking.
Either one, both of you. I mean, because if you're not tracking in terms of like what, when, weight, like those things, what are the other pieces of information that you have about yourself? Like, what do you use to gauge if you're feeling like good on track?
I mean, specifically for running, it comes down to like the day to day. Like if I'm waking up and going for an easy run feels great, like then I know, you know, everything's coming aligned. If I go out and do a race and I hit the times where I thought that I could and it like all makes sense, then I'm like, okay, it's working. And cool. I spent such a long time with Megan tracking that I learned what works and what doesn't and have created habits from working one-on-one with her. So that obviously helps a lot.
Yeah. And that's awesome. So what you're able to use now there's a really strong knowledge base, which came from both having like professional guidance in that way. And then also with some like trial and error, trying things out and really learning for yourself what works for your body. And yeah. then you've built these, they become implicit, but they are, they're systems for understanding the information that your body is giving. So how you feel energetically when you're waking up and when you're going on those runs, and like, do you have the energy that you need? And like, is your body able to recover and perform in those particular ways that you're pretty familiar with? And so you are able to use pretty metric free, you still have very accurate information about whether your body to do the things you're doing has the fuel and nourishment that it needs.
We're missing one variable though.
What's that?
Megan, before she started working with Feathers, had a crippling cramp situation going on at the end of races.
Yep.
So she was very in tune with her body and very in tune with what was going on, and you were desperately looking for a solution.
Yeah.
So I think that immediately there was some, you bought in 100% with Feathers and everything that was going on because you had immediate proof that
yeah.
it was working.
Yeah, right. Which, you know, there not everybody is going to be wide open to it or ready to like dive in. But I think it's such a, it's such a clear example of kind of in contrast to somebody who says, I need to look at like the scale and what my body weighs. And like, that's the one singular metric each day that tells me whether I'm like good or bad. That is like, it's too small of a metric, and it's not accurate in terms of running, or any other sport for that matter. What information, all of the information that you need to make, like real decisions about what you're doing. And so it's highlighting that you don't just like, you know, stop caring about metrics or like not ever use metrics. It's that you can get to a point where you understand the feeling, you understand those cues that your body gives, you know what kind of felt metrics to be looking for. And it comes from a solid foundation of information and not just like, I decided. unless you're Megan Featherston, you can't just decide. nutrition. but I think a lot of people feel like, I don't know how I'd get to that point, but it helps us sort of see that pathway of how yeah. they might get to that point. So
for sure.
Yeah. Feathers, how do you tell?
So many good nuggets here. I love it. how do I tell? I've never been a nutrition tracker. Never. Like, I've had bad habits in the past, and I think it helps me be better at what I do. But I think changing them and noticing those changes, but I've always done that without tracking. Mm. And I would kind of echo what Meg says. If I'm sleeping well, if my mood is positive, if I don't have preoccupying thoughts about X, Y, or Z, whether it's running, whether it's food, whether it's body image, whatever it is, if yep. everything just starts to click, right? And then there are times, you know, that negative thoughts about running come in, or expectations that aren't healthy come in, you know, and that's where those are always kind of my triggers of, okay, well, what else is happening that we need to address? And yeah. to, because it's not that thought that's the problem. There's something causing that thought. So I think it's taken a long time, right? Like, I feel like in my late 30s, I was much better at understanding myself and my thoughts and my patterns and habits and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not saying I've always been this way. Mm-hmm. But I do think just being very in tune with what is my normal mm-hmm. and when things kind of start to not feel normal, whether it's physically, whether it's emotionally, whether some of my natural patterns of sleep and eating, those types of things become affected. It's like, wait, what's actually happening here? And really trying mm-hmm. to catch things early to yeah. get myself kind of back to that equilibrium that works for me.
Super smart. Love that.
All right, wow. Emily, we've taken up plenty of your time today, but I have to tell you, you're one of those people, like when we sat down at lunch in Boston, that you just immediately feel like a friend. And I don't know if
not
that's...
Not to me.
I'm a direct threat to Thomas.
I was very quiet.
Okay, well, to me, you just immediately, you have just this very warm, but like loving presence, and I mean, I hope that people, it comes through in this podcast, because you're lovely to be around.
Thank you. That is maybe the nicest compliment, and definitely something that I value a lot. So thank you for saying that. And
pretend I said it too.
It's okay. We can be frenemies. No, this is a really just fun time and great conversation to have, and I'm so grateful to be connected to all of you, and also be able to share and just help people explore running, and not just shoes, right? But fuel and mind and body and shoes. So
yeah, I mean, I think it's an amazing resource for people to have. You know, if Meg was stuck in the marathon training where she was hitting that wall with the cramps, she found Megan Featherston, was able to get past it. There's other people who are probably stuck on, you know, psychological barriers that maybe this is the unclogging you need, and you can, and get to that next. And I say next level, doesn't need to be a next level, just an enjoyment out of something that is bringing a lot of joy to your life.
Yeah, you're right on. Like, next level doesn't have to mean faster. Like, next level is whatever is meaningful for you. Like, moving forward progress.
I love it. Yeah. So if somebody's listening and they're like, "Oh my gosh, I need Emily Saul in my life." How do they get you in their life?
Well, you can always contact me through Instagram, Emily Saul Boston, or through my website, esaulmovement.com, or just email me, esaulmovement@gmail.com.
I love it. Thank you so much for being here. This is going to be so valuable for so many people to listen to. So we really appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you all. I'm excited, and we'll talk more anytime.
Awesome. Thanks, Emily.